I live in Russian Spencer, which is a nice sort of 15 minutes away from the office.
Right.
I've been up there 12 months now, which is in a very small way, 25 acres. We have 80 sheep and about a dozen cattle. It's a full-time job outside the full-time
right.
job.
Right. So you're full-time for the NFU.
Yeah.
And you've only been there for a year.
Yes.
So would you describe yourself as a farmer, smallholder, or a bit of both? Or?
I hate the word smallholding.
Ah, now, why do you hate it?
Because it gives the impression of, I'm going to contradict myself here as well, of a hobby farmer, which I keep saying, mine's an expensive hobby, so I suppose I am one. Smallholding, you think of the 5 acres and a couple of pigs and a couple of hens and a couple of sheep, and I'm farming on a small scale and doing it the same as I would be if I had 250 acres or whatever, so... So, I keep saying I'm living my dream. I've always wanted to farm again. Come from a farming family in Northumberland. Used to shear sheep for a living, do various different jobs on farms. Left school at 16 to work on a farm. So getting back to my roots really.
So you farmed in the northeast. Your family mm-hmm. did. What kind of farming was that?
It was beef and sheep as well.
Oh right.
It's on the National Trust estate called Warrington Hall. Have you ever heard of it?
Oh no. Where in Northumberland is it?
Near Morpeth. Beautiful part of the country. God's country.
It is gorgeous up there. So you were doing that. Was that go back into generations with your family?
I've been at the farm since 1933, I think it was. Something, I had the chance to take the farm over, decided to go and work elsewhere because there wasn't income at the farm at the time. And my brother took over from my father at later date, so...
You say the farm wasn't making enough money at the time. This is so you know the ins and outs really of what can make a farm function.
I think I was 13 and our bank appointed an advisor, said we had to sell all the cows and plough the land up into crop, and it broke my heart as a 13-year-old. Yeah. You know, I loved the cows, and so I know all about the ins and outs of things.
Right. So what period was that going on then?
That'd be the 80s. Early 80s,
yeah. So it's very much something you've lived with. So the moving into working for the NFU, how did that come about?
I had a serious road accident back in 1997.
Right.
Didn't work for 3 years afterwards, recovering from that.
Right.
And I always remember our NFU group secretary used to come in his 1.6 Ford Capri. It was a 2 litre or whatever, and then eventually came with this 2.8 injection special. I don't know if you remember Ford Capris. But they were great cars, and I thought that must be quite a good job. And that, you know, away from that money side, all the rest of it, but it always interested me. And the job, I think, for most people isn't quite what you think it is. You think it's NFU, and that's it. Well, you hear that they do a bit of insurance as well, and in fact, you do a lot of insurance and a little bit of NFU, varying amounts of NFU work. Because I tend to do a lot more than most. So.
So it is. It's not core work then. Work with farmers is not core.
It is for me.
I mean, it is for you.
Different areas. Some NFU officers will perhaps be 50% what we call the core market, which is the farming, and 50% wider market, where more like 65% farming.
Right. So what's your actual job title for the NFU?
I am NFU Group Secretary. Because I'm employed by the NFU, and I'm self-employed with NFU for NFU Mutual, with the insurance side. So I work on a commission basis for that.
Right, okay. But you're also working hard on your 25 acres with your sheep and cattle as well. So has anyone helped you on the farm at home? Have you got
my girlfriend, and also Beth, who works in offices, my girlfriend's daughter, she comes and helps quite a bit.
Okay.
Another group secretary locally, he comes and helps me. Very fortunate to help people.
Right.
They love doing it as well.
So how long have you been doing the work for the NFU? How long have you worked since?
I came down here in 2000. Right. So 15 years now.
So where's your sort of spread, your area that you work?
So we have 4 branches. So we monitor the River Dane in Rushton. So I live just on the edge. And then we kind of leak down to Waterhouse and across to Longna, to sort of Buxton, as far as we go. Something.
Right. So you're working a lot of the time with upland
farmers
and sort of
The fortunate thing for me is in this area, we're totally livestock. We go to other areas and people have arable, they have vegetable, you know, market gardening, as well as like purely grass here, dead simple.
And that's your interest? That's what you come from? You come from farming with stock and that's what you're into?
That's what I understand best. So.
Sure. So in 15 years, I mean, because I'm quite an old person now, it just seems like a blink of an eyelid, but in those 15 years, actually, there have been huge changes.
Well, not long after I started. I started in May 2000, and then it was February 2001. Of course, we had the Bigfoot and Mouth epidemic. string, and that always puts a shiver down my spine whenever I think of that, because it was horrendous times.
Can you just say a little bit more about that, what the impact was?
Well, things like we couldn't go out the office, we worked purely from here. We had a lot of customers came in those days it wasn't emails, it was faxes, and people had this streams and streams of pages of movement licenses, moving cattle and sheep and things, and people came and used our fax quite a lot, and we were the shoulder to cry on sometimes, and you know, there was the Addington Trust Fund where people could get a bit of financial assistance, and people struggled. In fact, it's amazing how many people, you know, kept going in those times.
Apart from anything else, there was this massive emotional, psychological strain of it.
We were very fortunate. We weren't affected in this area. You go to your Toxter and further over, they did have foot and mouth, but we didn't actually have any here.
No,
it was equally as bad in some ways that we didn't. My brother at home, he was within one farm of it, and in some ways he thinks now perhaps we'd be better off if being culled. He fought tooth and nail not to be culled. His neighbours who were culled had good compensation packages. They had new sheds, put up new vehicles.
Yeah, not being able to shift and sell stock was perhaps more financially ruinous, was it, for people?
In some ways,
yeah. More bruising in a way.
Mm.
Foot and mouth, well, that was the first huge thing that you had to sort of deal with working for the NFU. But you were perhaps really getting to understand the issues for farmers in this sort of territory. And what would you say in the kind of, I don't know if you can call it a recovery period, but the survival period that followed on from foot and mouth, what would you say that were some of the biggest issues in the early part of the 21st century for farmers, stock farmers in this area?
Your livestock prices were very poor. Those livestock was perhaps away from the main holding, couldn't get them back. There was a scheme where there was a lot of stock were culled. That kept some people going. I think it was more or less paid on the set value, so it didn't matter how good or bad they were. You'll see where there's a schemer. Some people benefit from it. Some people would be embarrassed and ashamed to admit they'd done that. Only recently I remember hearing of, you know, some very good farmers who, they put some stock on it and they got rid of a lot of...
A lot of the rubbish, so...
Yeah, which, you know, it's only a limited case
on
that, but
it
is human nature almost.
Yeah.
And I think it was mainly the poor livestock prices, people struggling to get back on their feet again.
How long did that carry on being a problem as a result?
I'd say it was a couple of years afterwards, really.
Right.
And I mean, there was, obviously some people were restocking after foot and mouth, but they weren't costing a great deal, they were still getting them fairly cheaply. Compared to the packet, the compensation packages they had. Because, of course, the valuers were paid on a percentage basis. So, you know, an auctioneer comes and values your stock before they're slaughtered. If he's on 5% or whatever, he wants that value as high as possible, because that means he gets more. Bit of a silly way to pay a man. That's government.
Yeah. So that distorted things badly. Do you know people who went out of business?
It's amazing how everybody does keep going. You know, difficult times at the moment. You know, they keep saying how bad dairy farming is. As yet, not many gone out. There are the odd one who are probably getting to that age where they were thinking of packing in anyway, the age getting the better of them. It's now a good time. Cows are still making reasonable prices. Why trudge on making nothing? You may as well get rid. So there are the odd one doing that now.
Yeah, if we sort of think about the sort of milk industry, I mean, the price for milk has been held down at unbelievably low levels, isn't it? What are the kind of the dates and the figures for sort of when they got so depressed, because I mean, we hear that in real terms it's 20 years, is it, they've not gone up?
We had a meeting with our local MP last week.
Who is the local MP?
Karen Bradley.
Yeah.
And one farmer, very open on his business and accounts and all the rest of it. And his example was he produced about 1 million litres. So he said, you know, dead easy numbers to play with. And compared to what he was getting just over 12 months ago, on the price we're getting from next month, it means £140,000 per year less. And that's quite scary.
Mm.
I mean, you could look at the fact of been doing very well in the past, which he'll admit it was the best year he'd ever had. But at the same time, you know, all that investment he was wanting to do and was going to do, and that money was letting him do, because it is a fault that's thrown at farmers quite a lot, but they do like to spend the money when they have it. There's not many of them hoard it up. You know, they will buy that new tractor or put that new parlour in or put another shed up. They all want to keep going on. You know, not many of them stand still.
Can you explain from your point of view, or from the NFU point of view, or from as a farmer even, what the structures are for setting milk prices? Because farming is like nothing else, isn't it? It's like the market value of what you produce shifts all the time. So we like to blame the supermarkets. Is that true?
Well, they do keep put on the shelves at a very low price to try and allegedly get customers in. I've always struggled to believe that it does work, but it must do, otherwise they wouldn't keep doing it. So they keep saying
it's a loss leader.
So they keep saying. And wouldn't it be fair if they kept changing what they use? Whereas milk does seem to keep the one the target. But at the same time, milk, you know, was a pound for the 4 pounds for a good while. So they've dropped it to 89 pence. So rough mathematics, roughly it's 11%, give or take a bit. The milk price of the farmers has dropped a whole lot less, a lot more than the 11%. So someone's making money somewhere.
But
they're still knocking more and more off all the time.
What's the price that farmers get currently?
It's always a kind of a bit behind, but I know for July was something like 23.2 pence or something like that. But now each month it's keep going down. So actually today it's probably 21 a bit or something. And there's someone only getting teens of pence. And then there's also, it's artificially propped up by those on the supermarket contracts, the dedicated supply contracts, who are still above 30 pence. So we've got people, someone over 30 and someone under 20 for exactly the same product. And some goes, like the farm went to last week, his milk gets picked up by Wiseman, and he's on, I think, about 23 pence. And on the same tanker, the Tesco Wiseman gets picked up, which is paid at 31 a bit at the moment.
Into the same tanker?
Yeah.
So that milk's mixed up together. Yeah.
Good God.
To the same standards and everything? Yeah. Even those that are saying, like Tesco have this big headline of, you know, we pay our dairy farmers sustainable living and all, so we can pay themselves a wage and money to reinvest and all the rest of it. But there's only a certain percentage of their milk is actually from those dedicated supply contracts. The rest comes from the farmer we're at who just gets chucked in with it.
Does it tend to be the big people who get those contracts?
As a rule, yes, because it's all about keeping costs down. So if they can stop and get 20,000 litres from one farm, cost them less than getting 5,000 litres from four farms, isn't it?
So who are the ones then are surviving all this? It's always been the bigger farms, has it? We've managed to sort of roll.
Well, I would argue the big ones are probably struggling as much as any in some ways. It's all about which contract you're on. If you're on a good Tesco or Sainsbury's contract, you haven't got any worries.
There was a demonstration, was it last week actually, or just the week before last, where farmers are just saying they're now producing milk at their own losses.
Yeah.
I mean, how...
I say those on teens of pence will be. Yeah. There's the, sort of one of the last remaining farmer cooperatives is First Milk, and they're struggling financially. Each farm has to, I mean, it's about 4 pence per litre, the First Milk take back off them. It's not investing in the company, it's paying the wages and probably paying their month's wage back the next time. So if you're only getting perhaps 17, 18, 19 pence, and they're taking 4 pence off you, you're left with half as much as the man on a Tesco contract.
What's your view of, like, the price level that should be the minimum below, which you could never go? Is it 25, something like that, or...?
I think 25 would be a reasonable amount that, you know...
Would make it possible for people to function.
Yeah, because it is a, you know, 365-day-a-year job. You know, and those cows want milking twice a day, every day of the year, and it is a major commitment. Yes... I'm sure dairy farmers and most will agree that when the circumstances are right, they can make very good money. But they've had to earn it. And there's a massive amount of investment, 200 cows or whatever, might be averaging £1,500 a head or whatever. You're talking about a lot of money just in the livestock, let alone milking parlours that probably started about 50,000 up to 150,000 now. If you want a robotic milker, they're about 80 or 90,000 each, which only milk 60 cows. So there's a lot of cost.
The costs of dairy farming are sort of massive. A lot of people would say some of those costs are environmental ones and even animal welfare ones in some cases. I mean, what's your view about that? I mean,
there's
sort of
good and bad
discussions
in whatever you do. Yeah. There's some very good farmers and there's some very bad ones. Not going to deny that. The only problem is the small minority who are the bad ones spoil it for the majority who do a very good job. But say you'll find that in any walk of life.
When I was living in Yalgrave, I just watched one after another after another dairy farm, just after foot and mouth, just sort of saying, I don't want this life anymore. And it was one after another would go.
Well, if you've got no family coming through, you might have had three daughters, they'll all go off, get a job somewhere. Is there any point in carrying on? It's all about. I always remember there was the Lambing Live programme, I think it was last year or the year before, and there was a guy on there who said, if people who save, I'd rather my son went and got a bank manager's job or, you know, worked in industry or solicitor or whatever. He said, absolute rubbish. You slog your guts out, you're wanting to pass this down to your next generation. And of course you are. That's the sole reason you do it. It's all about pride. You want to say, look, I've done a great job, here you are, son, have it. And, you know, carry on the tradition for that. Because most families do keep going a very long time, you know, on the same farm for a lot of years.
I mean, that's obviously something that you've lived and that's something that you've cared about. And the thing that really speaks very loudly to me is that the family is such an essential part of what the farming enterprise.
Go back to what you're saying about, you know, the big farms doing well. They will struggle because big farms have big costs. And families can't run big farms as a rule. You're paying outside labour. The milk price goes down, the employees still want their wages. You wouldn't expect any different. Whereas you have a family farm, you haven't got their costs. A lot of the business expenses kind of come out of the farm, which also pay the son's living expenses and all the rest of it. And you can sort of batten down the hatches and make do. You don't need to keep perhaps renewing the machinery you manage because it's your family. You do without a wage, you live, you don't go hungry, but you don't have a holiday. Personally, I think the medium-sized farm will probably keep going the best.
You know, I was terribly aware of so many people going in a shift over to beef, and actually beef fattening.
Mm-hmm.
So just buying cattle that they don't know, really, just to fatten them up a bit, which has become quite an issue in the area that I know quite well, in terms of not knowing the stock, them actually being quite dangerous, being around footpaths and all this sort of business. Are there many people who've done that sort of, you know, switch over, come out of dairying and moved into new areas of farming?
Well, a few have said that cattle and cows just the same, but totally different. Dairy cows are so quiet and calm. You get the beef animals because they're not handled as much, so they are very temperamental. On the insurance side, we know a number of issues with people getting injured on footpaths, but partly because of budget education. You know, people go walking with a dog. And to me, if I was with a dog or without a dog, you go into a field where there's cattle, I don't care where the footpath is, you walk around the outside of that field, so if they do come to you, you can help over the fence. But people are walking on the footpath. Then of course the cattle come, and we've had one where instead of letting the dog go, the dog will get away 99 times out of 100. One lady lay on the dog to protect the dog. So of course the cattle hurt her. And it's just, no hope.